at a heavy-set guy with an unruly beard who seemed to be eyeing me suspiciously. Seated across from him was a teenaged African-American girl who looked like she probably wasn't old enough to drive yet. A young Asian man sat beside her. He looked like he was in his early 20s, and there was a small Chinese flag beneath the EDA emblem on his uniform, instead of the tiny embroidered version of Old Glory that adorned everyone else's uniform. And, instead of the words Earth Defense Alliance, there was a string of characters in Chinese. After the five of us had stared at each other in silence for what I felt was a sufficient length of time, I stowed my pack in the overhead compartment and took the empty seat next to the older woman, because she was the only one who had smiled at me. "Hi," I said, offering her my hand. "I'm Zach Lightman, from Portland, Oregon." As dazed as I was, I still remembered to say I was from Portland instead of Beaverton to avoid sounding like a hick or having to endure any beaver-related attempts at humor. "Welcome aboard, Zach," she said, squeezing my hand between both of her own. "I'm Debbie Wynn." Something about her demeanor and tone made me guess that she was a schoolteacher. "It's nice to meet you, Debbie."
"It's nice to meet you, even under such terrifying circumstances."
She laughed and gave me an anxious smile. I returned it with one of my own.
"That's Milo,"
she said, gesturing to the bear-like man to her left, who was still staring at me with open hostility. The name patch on his uniform identified him as Lieutenant Dobson. "Hi there, Milo," I said, reaching over to offer him my hand. "How goes it?" He just stared at my hand without replying until I finally shrugged and lowered it.
"Oh, ignore him. He's from Philly,"
Debbie said, as if that explained his rude behavior. Then she nodded at the young woman across from her.
"Zach, that's Lila. Lila, meet Zach."
"Nobody actually calls me that," the girl said. "Everyone calls me by my nickname, Wody. That's my Armada call sign, too."
We shook hands, and I was about to tell her that I recognized her call sign, but then the young man beside her cleared his throat. The name Lieutenant Chen was stitched onto his uniform.
"This is Zhang Chen, better known as Crazy Xi," Wody said. "He's Chinese and doesn't speak much English."
Chen smiled and shook my hand. He had spiky red hair that obscured the right half of his face, but the look seemed to work for him. Chen glanced down at the QCOM strapped to his right wrist, where a string of Mandarin characters was appearing on his display.
It must have been translating what Wody had said, because after Chen read over them, he looked up and gave me an exhausted smile.
"Hello," he said with a thick accent. "It good to meet you."
"It's good to meet you, too," I replied slowly.
"I know your call sign well, Crazy Xi."
"Yours too, Wody. We've flown lots of missions together. It's an honor to finally meet you in person."
I stood up and held out my hand.
"I'm Zach, also known as Iron Beagle."
As soon as they heard my call sign, the tension in the tiny cabin evaporated, and all four of my new companions visibly relaxed, especially Milo, who actually smiled in my direction for the first time since I'd stepped aboard.
"The Beagle,"
Wody repeated, smiling with recognition.
"Good to finally meet you. You're a fucking legend, man."
I saw Debbie wince when Wody dropped her F-bomb.
"Iron Beagle?"
Chen repeated with raised eyebrows in what sounded like perfect English. When I nodded, he lunged out of his seat to shake my hand, talking excitedly in Chinese. An English translation appeared on my QCOM, a garbled string of compliments for which I thanked him profusely. Once he finally calmed down and let go of me, we both retook our seats.
"What's your call sign, Debbie?"
I asked, even though I already had a good guess, just due to the process of elimination. She laid a hand on her chest and bowed her head.
"Atomic Mom, at your service," she smiled nervously. "You know, like atomic bomb?"
"Yeah, lady, we get it," Milo said, rolling his bloodshot eyes. "Let me guess," I said, leveling a finger at him. "You're Cushmaster 5000, right?" He smiled, looking immensely pleased.
"The one and only."
The Cushmaster, also known as KM5K to his many detractors, was a pilot known for his incessant and often unintentionally hilarious boasting and trash talk on the Chaos Terrain player forums, where he used a prismatic cannabis leaf for his avatar. He also loved to do a running voice commentary of the battles over the public comm channel, like Jack Burton broadcasting on his CB. I usually muted him, but I still recognized his Philly accent and the cocky attitude that seemed to come along with it. I wasn't sure I liked him, and he seemed to like it that way.
But in a strange way, learning their call signs suddenly made me feel as though I was among old friends, or at least familiar allies. Atomic Mom, Wody, Crazy G, and Kushmaster 5000 were all names that I'd been seeing daily for the past year, because they were four of the call signs always listed among the top 10 Armada pilot rankings, at first above and then eventually below my own. When I'd checked the rankings last night, Wody's call sign had been listed right after mine in 7th place, followed by Crazy G in 8th, Atomic Mom in 9th, and Kushmaster 5000 in 10th.
"Sorry if I acted like a prick before," Milo said, solemnly offering me his fist to bump, which I did. "I thought you might be Red Jive and one of those other elitist dicks in the top 5.
Chen read the translation, then whispered a response into his QCOM in Chinese. The device instantly translated his words and repeated them in English.
"I was thinking the same thing," the computer said, in a synthesized male voice that sounded exactly like the one used by Stephen Hawking.
I suddenly found myself wondering if Hawking had been part of the EDA's big cover-up, too. And what about Neil deGrasse Tyson? If Carl Sagan had been let in on the secret, it seemed possible that other prominent scientists had, too. I added this to the list of unanswered questions whirling around inside my head, which seemed to only be growing longer as this insane day progressed.
"I am not liking Red Jive also," Chen's translator went on to declare loudly in its uninflected monotone. "He is an asshole total."
Wody laughed and mimicked the translator's voice while she made stiff robotic motions with her arms.
"Yes," she intoned. "The Baron is complete face fuck."
The others laughed, but I shifted uncomfortably in my seat. Luckily, my dad's impromptu roast was interrupted a second later when the hatchway leading to the cockpit slid open and an aethid clanked through it on metal feet. The drone's head split open and extended a small flat-screen telepresence monitor that displayed a live video image of the drone's operator, a middle-aged EDA officer with an impressive Sam Elliott gauge mustache.
"Welcome aboard," he said. "I'll be your shuttle pilot today, Captain Meadows."
The second he finished introducing himself, he was bombarded with questions from all sides in a variety of accents and in at least 2 languages. I wanted to ask him a few thousand of my own, but he was already holding up one of his drone's clawed hands, motioning for silence. It took a minute. "I'm not authorized to answer your questions," he said. "Your new commanding officer will brief you as soon as we arrive at the moon base. If you have any other questions and the answers aren't classified, you can find them using the EDA Recruit Orientation Manual app on your QCOM. Understood?" Everyone nodded and glanced down at their QCOMs. "Outstanding," the captain said in response to our silent compliance. "We'll depart in just a few minutes. But before we leave, I'm told there's someone who wants to see you off." He motioned to the open hatchway just as a familiar-looking middle-aged man with red hair stepped through it, leaning into the shuttle's crowded cabin. He greeted everyone with a gleaming, press-photo-friendly smile.
"Finn Arbogast?" several of us said in unison.
"Guilty as charged," he said, grinning and slightly out of breath. "I ran all the way down here from the ops center so I wouldn't miss my chance to finally meet all of you."
He went around the cabin, giving each of us a firm handshake in turn.
"You 5 people have been the pride and joy of the Chaos Terrain Project for a long time now. In fact, your talent and dedication were what helped us convince the higher-ups that our civilian simulator training initiative could actually work on a global scale. So thank you."
I'd seen plenty of photos and video interviews with Chaos Terrain's founder, but in person, he was shorter than I expected. He shook my hand last, and when our eyes met, he cocked his head at me sideways.
"You're Zach Lightman, aren't you?"
he said, shaking his head as he studied my face. The famous Iron Beagle. I nodded. He glanced around at the others, then gave me a sheepish grin.
Listen, Lieutenant, Arbogast said. I hope Admiral Vance wasn't too hard on you earlier. There was no way you could have known about the security blockade doors on those drone launch tunnels. No enemy ship ever attempted that maneuver during any of their attacks against our moon base, so we never included it as a possibility in any of your Armada training missions. He shrugged. Live and learn, I guess.
I glanced around the cabin. Everyone was staring at me in wide-eyed surprise.
That was you? Milo said, laughing. You're the kamikaze dumbass who chased that glaive fighter into the hangar before it went kaboom?
I nodded. Everyone stared at me for an awkward beat. Then Arbogast clapped his hands.
Well, I know you're about to depart for MBA, so I don't want to hold you up, he said. I just wanted to thank each of you and commend you for your bravery.
Excuse me, sir, Milo said in his thick Philly accent. But where the hell is Red Jive? You know, the Red Baron? He's the top-ranked Armada pilot in the world, right? So why ain't he here? Aren't you going to recruit him, too?
Arbogast shot a glance at me, then looked back at Milo.
Red Jive was recruited decades ago, he said. He's our most decorated pilot.
Arbogast studied my reaction while the others exchanged looks of surprise.
But who the hell is he? Milo asked. Or she?
He gave Wody and Debbie a placating smile. Arbogast nodded. Red Jive is the call sign used by General Xavier Lightman. One at a time, the others each turned to look at the name patch sewn onto my uniform. Then they all stared at me for a few seconds. When I failed to say anything, Debbie finally broke the silence.
Any relation, Zach? She asked quietly.
I looked at Arbogast. He seemed interested in hearing how I would answer, too.
He's my father, I said. But I never knew him.
I grew up believing he died when I was still just a baby. I just found out the EDA faked his death when they recruited him. They all stared back at me in silence, taking this in. Except for Chin, who had to read the translation off his QCOM before he understood what I'd just said. When he looked up from its display a few seconds later, he let out a long, low whistle.
And now you're on your way to the moon to meet him for the first time, Debbie said.
I nodded.
Jesus, kid, Milo said, shaking his head. And I thought my day was turning out weird.
I turned back to Arbogast.
Do you know him?
A little, he said. I had the honor of working with General Lightman briefly a few years ago. He was one of our primary military consultants on Armada. He studied my face for a second, then shook his head.
You look just like him.
I nodded. Yeah, so I keep hearing. We heard a low whine as the shuttle engines began to power up. Arbogast stood up straight and snapped us all a clumsy salute.
Thank you again for your service, he said. And good luck up there.
Then he exited the shuttle before anyone could even return his salute. After he left, the Aethid Meadows was controlling turned to slap a large red button on the bulkhead. The shuttle's doors slid closed with a pressurized hiss, barely audible over the growing roar of the engines.
Strap in, recruits, Meadows told us over his comm. We're cleared for departure.
I pulled on my safety harness and fumbled with the buckle until it finally clicked into place. Then I pulled the straps tight against my chest. Once everyone was properly buckled in, Meadows Aethid gave us all a robotic thumbs up.
The journey to Moonbase Alpha should only take about 40 minutes, he said. Once we clear the Earth's atmosphere, we'll be moving extremely fast. If we run into any hostiles along the way, you'll each be able to use your QCOMs to control one of the omnidirectional laser turrets mounted on the underside of the hull. But our scopes are clear right now, so it should be smooth sailing. Just sit back and try to enjoy the ride.
The drone returned to the cockpit, and I saw it dock with its charging station just before the hatch closed. When I glanced around the cabin, I found that my companions were once again staring at me. Debbie and Wody quickly averted their eyes, but Milo and Chen both just kept right on staring, as if a sparkly horn had suddenly sprouted from my forehead. I ignored them as long as I could, then I slowly mimed cranking up the middle finger of my right hand. When it reached full mast, they both finally seemed to get the hint and looked away. I took out my QCOM and tried punching my mother's mobile number into the keypad, but the call didn't go through, and a notice popped up informing me that access to the civilian phone system was still restricted. I sighed and snapped the QCOM back onto my wrist. We lifted off a few minutes later. As before, the ride remained perfectly smooth, even as the shuttle climbed through the atmosphere and accelerated to escape velocity, and the sky outside our windows gradually began to turn from light blue to pitch black. And this time, when we reached the edge of all that blackness, the shuttle didn't turn around and begin to fall back to Earth. We kept right on going, out into space. As on my first shuttle trip, the gravity inside the cabin never wavered, and when I closed my eyes, it felt as if we were motionless, even though we were moving so fast that, within just a few minutes, we'd already traveled far enough away from Earth for me to be able to see the entire planet all at once. Something I dreamed of doing for as long as I could remember. I stared down at the radiant blue-white sphere that was home to everything and everyone I loved, and scanned the gaps in the swirling cloud layer until I located the western coastline of North America, then followed it until I spotted the familiar inlet of Portland, just barely visible. I realized then just how far away I already was from home, and it was getting farther and farther away every second. That's what we're fighting for, I thought. That's what they're trying to take from us. I pressed my face against the window beside me, craning my neck to see as far ahead of us as possible. And there it was, a radiant gray-white bulb shining in the darkness far ahead of us. I'd spent my entire life believing that no human being had set foot on its surface since the last Apollo mission in 1972. Now, I was headed there myself, aboard a spacecraft that incorporated reverse-engineered alien technology to meet the father I had never known. What was he like now? What would he say when he saw me? How would I react? Across from me, I noticed that Debbie had her head down, and her hands were clasped together in her lap. Her eyes were closed, and she was moving her lips in silence. "What are you doing?" Milo asked, sounding genuinely curious. Debbie silently whispered amen to herself, then opened her eyes and looked over at him. "I was obviously trying to pray, Milo," she said. "You were praying?" he said, his voice dripping with sarcasm. "To who?" Debbie stared at him in disbelief. "To Jesus. Our Lord and Savior, of course." "Oh, yeah, of course," Milo said, chuckling. "Just one question, church lady. In what part of the Bible did Jesus warn us about this alien invasion?" He glanced around the cabin at the rest of us for support. "Because I must have missed that verse." Debbie stared back at him, instantly livid. She opened her mouth, but his question seemed to have her so flustered that she didn't know how to respond. Wody did, though. "And the fifth angel sounded," she recited, locking eyes with Milo. "And I saw a star fall from heaven unto the earth, and to him was given the key of the bottomless pit, and he opened the bottomless pit, and there arose a smoke out of the pit as the smoke of a great furnace, and the sun and the air were darkened by reason of the smoke of the pit." "What pit?" Milo asked. His smile was gone. "What are you talking about, kid?" I'd been raised to believe there was no real difference between religion and mythology. But Wody's words spooked me, nevertheless.
The verse she quoted conjured up a vivid memory of the cataclysmic fire and smoke roiling off the Crystal Palace blast doors as they buckled and warped under a hail of alien laser fire.
"And they worshipped the dragon which gave power unto the beast," she said. "And they worshipped the beast, saying, 'Who is like unto the beast? Who is able to make war with him?'"
When she finished, everyone just stared at her for a moment. Then Debbie began to applaud, and Chien and I joined in. Wodey blushed and looked down at her feet.
"My Uncle Franklin loves to quote scripture," she said, shrugging. "I've been hearing him recite Revelation since before I could walk."
"Well, I vote for no more Bible verses," Myla said, raising his right hand. "That seriously creeped me out."
Debbie nodded. "Quoting Revelations is probably a bad idea right now," she said. "I think we're all terrified enough already."
Wodey gave Milo and Debbie a look of disappointment before she replied,
"He which hath no stomach to this fat, let him depart," she recited, still glaring at the two adults. "His passport shall be made, and crowns for convoy put into his purse. We would not die in that man's company that fears his fellowship to die with us."
They both stared back at her for a long moment.
"What is it with you anyway, kid?" Milo asked finally.
Wodey shrugged again.
"The only thing my Uncle Franklin loves more than quoting scripture is quoting Shakespeare," she smiled to herself.
"I've seen all those Branagh and Zeffirelli movies about a zillion times each, so I know every word by heart."
Chien typed something into his QCOM's translator, then tilted it toward her.
"You are very smart, and you have an amazing memory," the synthesized voice said.
Even though his compliment came via a computer, it was enough to make her blush again as she whispered,
"Thank you."
She and Chien shared another glance. They seemed smitten with each other already, despite the language barrier.
"How old are you, Wodey?" Debbie asked, clearly trying to change the subject.
"I just turned 16 last week," she said. "But I don't have my license yet."
"You sound like you're from New Orleans," Debbie told her, doing her best to pronounce it Nollins.
Wodey nodded.
"I live in the 9th Ward," she said. "That's actually where my nickname comes from. Wodey is how the locals say Wardy. That's a person who lives in the same ward as you," she explained. "My parents called me Wodey ever since I was a baby. I didn't always like it because there were some boys at school who used to call me Wodey the Toady all the time. But then I punched their fucking lights out and they stopped."
She said this in such a sweet, girlish voice that I burst out laughing. So did Milo, but Debbie looked absolutely horrified.
"Lila," she said, wincing again. "Such language, honey. Your parents don't let you swear like that around them, do they?"
Wodey folded her arms.
"Well, no, they didn't used to," she said. "But they both died in a hurricane when I was little, so now I get to say whatever the fuck I want."
"Oh, snap,"
Milo muttered under his breath.
"You poor dear," Debbie said, looking embarrassed. "I'm sorry. I didn't know."
Wodey nodded and looked away, leaving Debbie to squirm in the silence that followed. That was when Milo decided to try to help salvage the conversation.
"Hey," he said, nodding at me. "Zach over there thought his father was dead, too, but he's not. Maybe your folks are still alive, too."
Wodey glared back at him, then shook her head slowly.
"They drowned," she said. "I saw their bodies."
She didn't elaborate. Milo was too taken aback to even respond. Wodey turned to look out the window, and I watched her, recalling what Admiral Vance had told me about not feeling too sorry for myself. "How about you, Debbie?" I asked, desperate to change the subject. "Where do you hail from?"
"Duluth, Minnesota," she said, giving me a grateful smile. "I'm a school librarian there. I also have 3 boys, all teenagers now. The oldest is only 15.
Her smile faded. "I didn't even get to say goodbye to any of them. They let me send my sister a text message asking her to pick them up, but I obviously couldn't say why."
"Can't your husband take care of them?"
Wodey asked,
Debbie glanced down at the wedding ring on her left hand, then smiled at Wody.
"I'm afraid not, dear," she said, meeting Wody's gaze. "Howard died of a heart attack last year."
Now it was Wody's turn to look embarrassed. "Sorry."
"It's all right," she said. "My boys are tough as nails. I'm sure they'll get through this fine. I just hope..."
Her voice hitched, but she went on.
"When I'm allowed to call them later, I just hope they understand why I couldn't stay with them through all of this."
"They'll understand," I said, with as much assurance as I could. "Your sons are gamers too, right?" She nodded.
"They all play Terra Firma together every night while their mom is playing Armada," she said. "We all have our computers set up next to each other in the living room."
"Then your boys will be fighting right alongside us," I said, smiling at her. "Right?" Debbie nodded and wiped her eyes on her sleeve.
"Right," she said. "That's right. I forgot."
"Fucking A!" Milo shouted. "We're gonna have Atomic Mom's boys whipping ass for our team, too?" He smiled at Debbie. "Those alien dipshits won't stand a chance."
To my surprise, Debbie returned his smile, and I found myself reconsidering my first impression of Milo. His Rocky Balboa-esque method of speaking somehow made his cocky enthusiasm seem endearing. Chen, who had just now caught up with the conversation via his translator, nodded vigorously in agreement with Milo, then spoke into his translator.
"I know my friends and family back home will be helping us fight, too," the software said for him, finally giving a coherent translation for once. "And that is very comforting to me."
"Thank you, Chen," Debbie said. "You too, Milo. You're right. That is comforting."
She twisted her hands into knots in her lap.
"But I'm still frightened for my family. And for all of us." She shook her head. "I never believed something like this could really happen. It's a nightmare."
"I don't know," Milo said, leaning back. "It seems more like a dream come true to me."
Debbie stared at him.
"Are you insane?" she asked. "How could you possibly think that?"
Milo shrugged.
"Yesterday I was living in a shitty basement apartment and working a soul-crushingly boring cubicle job." He motioned to the surreal view out the shuttle window. "Look at me now! I'm an officer in the Earth Defense Alliance, and I'm on my way to the fucking moon to help save Earth from an alien invasion."
He turned back to Debbie.
"Now, please explain to me how this isn't the greatest day ever, like, in history."
"Because we're all about to get killed, moron!"
she shouted back, with a tremor of hysteria creeping into her voice.
"Were you even paying attention during the Admiral's briefing? Did you see the size of their armada? We're going to be ridiculously outnumbered."
Milo seemed genuinely surprised.
"I may have missed that part of the briefing," he said. Then, under her withering glare, he added, "I have ADD. My mind wanders during long meetings."
For the first time, I detected genuine fear in his voice. "Are the odds really that bad? The Admiral never said..."
"What?" Debbie asked, interrupting him. "That we're probably doomed? Why would he say that out loud?"
She turned to look out the window.
"He doesn't need to. It's obvious. I mean, how desperate must the odds be if we're the Alliance's best hope? We're a bunch of gamer geeks, not soldiers."
"Yes, we are," Milo replied. "We all just enlisted, remember?"
He shook his head at her.
"Come on, lady. Can't you try and be a little more positive? This isn't over yet. We can still win this thing."
Debbie studied him for a moment before she replied.
"Don't you get it, Milo? No matter who wins, millions of people are going to die when the fighting starts a few hours from now."
He waved his hand at her dismissively.
"Oh, grow some balls. If killing these alien dipshits is half as easy as it is in the game, we're going to kick their European asses."
"European, Milo," I said. "You, rope, an. Not European."
"Whatever the fuck you want to call them," he sighed. "You know what I mean."
"I hate to say it," Wody said, "but I agree with Milo. If we beat them in the game,
We can beat them in real life. She looked around at the three of us hopefully. After all, we are the best of the best, right?
Before his QCOM even had time to finish translating for him, Chen jumped to his feet and shouted, "Right!" with a raised fist. Then he bared his teeth and shouted something that sounded like, "Shang Li!" His QCOM repeated the word in synthesized English, "Victory!" Wodi grinned and raised a fist of her own, then repeated after Chen, shouting, "Shang Li!" at nearly the same volume.
"Hell yeah!" Milo shouted, throwing up a pair of heavy metal horns. "Shang Li!"
Debbie glanced at me, waiting to see if I would take up their battle cry too. Privately, I shared her grim appraisal of our chances. But feigning optimism seemed like it would be better for everyone's morale, including my own. I raised a fist like the others. Then, with as much enthusiasm as I could muster, I repeated their cry of, "Shang Li!" I nudged Debbie with my elbow, and she sighed in resignation. "Shang Li!" she echoed, half-heartedly pumping her fist in the air. "Woo!" Chen grinned at all of us, leaned forward, and stretched out his right hand with his palm facing down. Wodi smiled back and stacked her hand on top of his. Then Milo, Debbie, and I each did the same thing. Then, in unison, we all shouted, "Shang Li!" one more time. A second later, we heard Captain Meadows' voice on the intercom again, announcing that we were on final approach to Moonbase Alpha. This seemed to make us self-conscious, and we all quickly withdrew our hands. The shuttle banked sharply, and the moon's cratered surface suddenly filled the portside windows as we rocketed into orbit. I caught a brief glimpse of the Tycho impact crater as we zoomed over it on our way around to the far side, which was mostly in shadow. This hemisphere of the moon always faced away from Earth, so it was the first time any of us were seeing it with our own eyes. The surface was marred by a few small blackened regions, which looked like burn marks. But there were no ocean-sized dark patches or seas like those that marred the moon's more familiar hemisphere. The landscape here on the far side of the moon was far more uniform in color and appearance, but that didn't make it seem any more inviting. As we sailed over the cratered and barren lunar surface, I was struck by a brief vision of Earth after the coming conflict. The battle had left our world ravaged and dead, as devoid of life and color as its own moon, its oceans and atmosphere burned away, its mighty cities replaced with impact craters, and the whole of its once beautiful surface scorched black by the fire of war. I shook my head and rubbed my eyes with the palms of my hands before looking back down at the lunar surface. The sun was low in the sky, causing the more prominent craters to cast long shadows that stretched out across the pockmarked surface like crooked black fingers. Far below, an enormous bowl-shaped crater slid into view, and the sight sent a chill cascading down my spine. I recognized this place. I was looking down at the Daedalus crater complex, the secret location of Moonbase Alpha. I'd known this was our destination, but I still hadn't been able to convince myself that it really existed until that moment, when I saw it with my own eyes. The large crater, Daedalus, had a much smaller, steeper crater named Daedalus B immediately adjacent to it, and a third, even smaller crater adjacent to that, known as Daedalus C. The lips of all three craters touched, and when viewed from directly above, their outline somewhat resembled the shape of a pocket watch, with Daedalus B standing in for the small round knob on top, and Daedalus C serving as the even smaller chain ring attached to it. These three craters immediately stood out from the thousands of others on the lunar surface, because even at this distance, they all contained obvious evidence of human construction. The walls of the big crater had been smoothed out and curved into a perfect bowl shape to create a dish antenna for an enormous radio telescope. Its design was similar to that of the Arecibo Observatory in the mountains of Puerto Rico, but several hundred times larger. The two smaller craters each had an armored sphere nestled inside, like a golf ball sitting atop a shot glass. They were made of armored metal plating that had been painted gray to match the lunar surface.
"Moonbase Alpha!"
Chen shouted as he spotted it too. Then he began to talk excitedly in Chinese as he pointed out things down on the surface. The others craned their necks to see out the nearest window, and they each gasped at their first glimpse of our destination.
"There it is," Wodey said, bouncing in her seat. "It's really there. It's really real."
Moonbase Alpha was a familiar sight to all of us because we'd flown our interceptors into and out of a simulated version of it hundreds of times while playing Armada. Our shuttle was even approaching along the same trajectory, giving me a strange sense of déjà vu. As we made our final approach, the dome at the top of the smaller sphere split apart into equal segments, like an orange, and retracted far enough to permit our shuttle entrance. As soon as we descended inside the dome, its armored segments slammed back together above us, sealing the hangar bay once again, which essentially functioned like a giant airlock. Its design had always reminded me of the docking bay of the fictional Clavius base featured in 2001 A Space Odyssey. Now I found myself wondering if the EDA had borrowed elements from Stanley Kubrick's design. After all, stranger things had obviously happened, and were still happening right now. Our shuttle touched down on the hangar floor a moment later, and when the engines cut out, an abrupt silence filled the cabin. The others were all pressed to the windows, but I couldn't look. I just sat there frozen in my seat, paralyzed by oscillating waves of anticipation and dread. Meadows' Aethid emerged from the cockpit and used one of its clawed hands to slap a large green button on the bulkhead. The safety bars around our seats retracted up into the ceiling as the doors opened with a hiss. "Leave your gear and follow me," Meadows told us over the drone's comm speaker. Then the Aethid turned and exited the shuttle, motioning for us to follow. Wodey immediately unbuckled her harness and literally jumped out of her seat. She was already running when her feet hit the floor.
"I can't believe we're on the moon,"
she said in childlike wonder, stretching her arms out wide as she leapt through the shuttle's open hatchway. I saw her sprint off and noticed that she didn't bounce as she ran the way the Apollo astronauts always did in footage of the moon landings, which meant the gravity up here was somehow being altered to match that of Earth. Chen struggled to get free of his own harness, then scrambled outside after Wodey. It took Milo slightly longer to extricate himself, but then he exited the shuttle too, grinning like a little kid on Christmas morning, leaving Debbie and me alone in the passenger cabin. She unbuckled her safety harness and turned in her seat to face me.
"You ready to head out there, Zach?"
I started to nod, but ended up shaking my head. "I spent my whole life fantasizing about this moment," I told her. "And now, I think I'm too terrified to even go out there."
"It'll be all right," she said. "He's probably just as nervous about meeting you. Maybe even a little more."
Meadows' Aethid stuck its head back into the cabin, with his telepresence monitor now deployed. He smiled at Debbie through the screen, then rotated his drone's head to address me. "The general is right outside in the hangar bay, waiting to meet you, Lieutenant." He turned to Debbie. "He asked me to escort you and the other new arrivals down to operations so that he and the lieutenant can have a few minutes in private. They'll join us there shortly."
"Of course," Debbie said, standing up.
She brushed a lock of hair off my forehead, then squeezed my shoulder and gave me another smile.
"See you in a few minutes, okay?"
I nodded. "Thanks, Debbie." She gave me one last smile before she departed with Meadows' Aethid. I sat there alone inside the cabin for a few seconds, summoning my courage. Then I thumbed the release latch on my safety harness and shrugged it off as I slowly got to my feet. When I finally stepped outside, he was right there, waiting for me. 15. He was just a few yards away from me, standing at rigid attention in a uniform just like the one I now wore. My father, Xavier Ulysses Lightman,
living and breathing and smiling. He was smiling at me with my own smile on an older version of my face. The man standing in front of me could have passed for my time-traveling future self, come back to warn me of our shared destiny. Out of the corner of my eye, I saw Meadows' aphid escort Debbie through a pair of armored doors at the opposite end of the hangar. Chen, Milo, and Wodey were waiting for them just inside the tunnel on the other side, along with an EDA officer I didn't recognize who had a Japanese flag on his uniform. The entire group gaped at us through the open airlock doors until the doors slammed shut again a second later with a dull boom that echoed through the vast hangar. I was only vaguely aware of their departure, or of my new surroundings, because all of my senses were now acutely focused on my father. The paternal ghost whose absence had haunted my entire adolescence now stood before me, miraculously resurrected. I found myself staring at a drop of sweat that had formed on his brow, and then watching as it rolled down the side of his face, as if this detail were proof this was really happening. It made me think of a scene in the original Total Recall, another movie I knew by heart because he'd once owned a copy on VHS. I took a long look at him while he did the same to me. As I drank in the details of my long-lost father's face, my first-hand familiarity with his features made it easy for me to detect the fear he was trying to conceal. He looked older than I'd expected, but that was probably because he'd never been older than 19 in every photo of him I'd ever seen. I think part of me was also subconsciously hoping that when I saw him, it would appear that he hadn't aged at all, because the EDA had frozen him in carbonite, or subjected him to light-speed time dilation to keep him young for the coming war. No such luck. He would be 37 now, the same age as my mother. But unlike her, he looked a decade older than his real age, instead of a decade younger. He still appeared to be in excellent physical condition, but his once dark hair was now shot through with gray, and there were prominent crow's feet around his eyes, which were the exact same shade of blue as my own. A hardened weariness seemed to permeate his features, and I wondered if I was getting a glimpse of what my face would look like if I somehow lived to be his age. I was still wondering that when I realized he was already moving toward me, closing the narrow distance between us, and then his arms were suddenly wrapped around me. A dam ruptured somewhere in my chest, and a torrent of feelings came rushing out of me all at once. I buried my face against him, and this triggered a long-dormant sense memory, the sensation of my father holding me just like this when I was still an infant. It may have even been my memory of the very last time he'd held me, before he vanished from my life forever. No, not forever, I told myself. Until right now. "I'm so happy to see you, Zach," he whispered, with a slight tremor in his voice. "And I'm sorry. So sorry for leaving you and your mother. I never imagined that I would be gone for so long." Each word he spoke made my heart swell, until it felt as if it might burst. In one breath, my father had just said all of the things I'd always dreamed of hearing him tell me, back when I'd still allowed myself to fantasize about him still being alive, and I was too overwhelmed to respond. Part of me was still sure that all of this was some sort of precarious dream, and that if I said or did the wrong thing, I would wake up, now, at the worst possible time. I tried again to speak, to tell him I'd been dreaming of this moment my entire life, but I still couldn't find my voice. My father seemed to take my continued silence as a negative sign. He let go of me and stepped back. Then he began to study my face, trying to decipher whatever dazed expression he saw there. "I've been waiting 18 years to tell you all of that, Zach," he said quietly. "I've practiced saying it in my head a million times. I hope I got it right. I hope I didn't screw it up." Absurdly, I found myself wishing that my mother were here, so she could introduce me to this complete stranger who was wearing my face. "You didn't," I finally managed to say, nearly inaudible. Then I cleared my throat and tried again. "You didn't screw it up," I said cautiously. "I'm happy to see you too." My father exhaled. "I'm relieved to hear that," he said. "I wasn't sure you would be." He smiled nervously. "You have every right to be angry. And I know you've got a temper, so..." He stopped speaking when he saw my smile vanish. Then he winced and contorted his brow, the exact same way I always did when I said something and instantly regretted it. "How could you possibly know if I've got a temper?" I asked, the anger rising in my voice like mercury. My father laughed involuntarily at the irony of my response, but it was lost on me, and his reaction only made me feel even more hurt and pissed off. Somehow, all of the excitement and euphoria I'd felt upon meeting him had dissipated in the span of a few seconds. "What makes you think you know anything about me at all?" "I'm sorry, Zach," he said. "But I'm your new commanding officer. I read over your EDA recruit profile, and it contains all of your civilian school and police records. All of my private psych evaluation results, too, I'll bet." He nodded. "The EDA finds out everything they can about potential recruits." I nodded. "Did my recruit profile mention that my anger management issues might be linked to the tragic death of my father in a shit factory explosion when I was 10 months old?" The question clearly hurt him, but I couldn't help but twist the knife a little farther. "What do you think it was like for me? Growing up, believing that's how my father died," I asked, "and having everyone in the whole town believe it too. Were you trying to ruin my life? Couldn't you have pretended to die in a fucking car accident or something instead?" He opened his mouth and then closed it a few times before he managed to form any words. "It wasn't like I had a choice, son," he said. "It had to be an explosion so that the body couldn't be identified. They buried a John Doe in my place." He met my gaze. "I'm sorry. I was a kid myself at the time. I didn't really understand what I was agreeing to do and to give up." We stood there, staring at each other in silence for a moment. Then my father's QCOM beeped. He glanced down at its display with a frown, then turned back to me. "We need to get up to operations and get you and the other new arrivals briefed," he said. "But we'll have a chance to talk more in private later on, okay?" I nodded mutely. I'd waited this long, and what choice did I really have? My father removed a small silver object from his pocket. "Here," he said, pressing it into the palm of my hand. "This is for you." I turned it over. It was a USB flash drive with an EDA emblem stamped on its casing. "What's on it?" "Letters mostly," he said. "I wrote to you and your mom every single day I was up here." I noticed that he was shifting his weight from one foot to another while he spoke, another of my own nervous tics. "I hope they help explain why I made the decision I did, and how hard it's been for me to live with ever since." He shrugged, still avoiding my gaze. "Sorry there are so many. You probably won't have enough time to read them all."
His voice faltered and he turned away from me to hide his face. I glanced down at the flash drive and closed my fist around it protectively, unnerved that so small an object could hold such priceless contents. My father raised the QCOM on his wrist and tapped a series of icons on its display. There was a metallic clank as a row of storage compartment doors built into the underside of the shuttle's fuselage slid open, revealing cube-shaped shipping containers. My father whispered a series of commands into his QCOM, and a few seconds later, a team of four Aethids disengaged from a nearby charging rack and marched single file over to the shuttle. Three of the drones began to unload the cargo, while the fourth climbed into the passenger cabin to retrieve our backpacks. "Ready, Lieutenant?" my father asked, nodding toward the exit. "Yes, sir," I replied, slipping the flash drive into one of my uniform's breast pockets so that it rested directly over my heart. Then, together, we continued to cross the hangar, and I finally widened my focus enough to take in the details of my surreal surroundings. The Moonbase Alpha Hangar Bay was a breathtaking sight. The curved walls of the armored dome around us were lined with hundreds of gleaming interceptor drones arrayed in the belt-fed launch racks that would fire them out into space like bullets from a high-velocity gas-powered machine gun. These were the drones we had been brought up here to pilot, I realized. We would use these very ships to wage war with the enemy when they arrived here, just over 5.5 hours from now. In that moment, I felt like Luke Skywalker, surveying a hangar full of A, Y, and X-Wing fighters just before the Battle of Yavin, or Captain Apollo climbing into the cockpit of his Viper on the Galactica's flight deck, Ender Wiggin arriving at battle school, or Alex Rogan clutching his Star League uniform, staring wide-eyed at a hangar full of gun stars. But this wasn't a fantasy. I wasn't Buck Rogers or Flash Gordon or Ender Wiggin or anyone else. This was real life. My life. I, Zachary Ulysses Lightman, an 18-year-old kid from Beaverton, Oregon, newly recruited by the Earth Defense Alliance, had just been reunited with my long-lost father on the far side of the moon. And now, together, we were about to wage a desperate battle to prevent the destruction of Earth and save the human race from total annihilation. If this were all just a dream, I wasn't sure that I would want it to end. But it was going to end. And soon. Because there was an egg timer strapped to my forearm counting off exactly just how many more hours, minutes, and seconds remained until my rude awakening. When my father reached the exit, he continued walking through the open airlock doors into the tube-shaped access tunnel beyond, which, if the layout of this place was as identical to its virtual counterpart in Armada as it seemed, led beneath the lunar surface to the adjacent Daedalus B crater where the rest of the base was located. But I stopped just shy of the exit and turned back to take another look at the thousands of interceptors racked into the curved dome wall around me and at the automated drone assembly plants at its far end, their matter compilers and nanobots working even now to construct more ADI-88s, which they would probably never have time to finish if what Vance had told me about the alien speed was true. I winced as another wave of shame washed over me at the memory of my colossal screw-up at Crystal Palace and the hangar full of drones it had cost us. But then I recalled one of the final images from the EDA briefing film of the Europan Armada, a massive, deadly ring of warships encircling the icy moon, all now headed toward Earth. Those drones we lost at Crystal Palace wouldn't have made any difference, nor would all of the drones here, or those stockpiled back on Earth. My father saw me lingering inside the hangar and ran back to fetch me. "What's wrong, Zach?" I laughed out loud at the absurdity of his question. "What's wrong?" I repeated. "Gee, let me think now. We need to get moving, Lieutenant," he said. "There isn't much time." But I didn't move. My father waited. I turned to study his face, then asked him the question I needed to ask. "How badly outnumbered are we going to be once the entire Armada arrives?" So badly it's not really even worth thinking about, he said immediately, without even pausing to consider his answer, and the lack of concern in his tone pissed me off all over again.
Then why the hell did you bring me up here? I asked. So that you could have a quick father-son play date before we both die horribly?
I jerked a thumb at the shuttle.
If we're doomed, just tell me right now. I'd rather fly that thing back home and die with my mother. She's all alone now, you realize.
My father looked as if I'd just gutted him, and I felt a pang of regret. But it was mingled with a twisted sense of satisfaction. It felt good to hurt his feelings. It was payback for the way his choices had irrevocably damaged my own. It took my father a moment to respond. When he did, his tone of voice had hardened. I didn't bring you up here, Lieutenant. You voluntarily enlisted as a soldier in the Earth Defense Alliance. You don't get to run home now just because you're scared. Trust me. I'm not scared, I said, lying right through my teeth.
If that's true, then you're a fucking idiot, he said matter-of-factly.
But I know that's not the case. He looked me in the eyes. I've been fighting this war for half my life now, Zach, and I'm terrified. You don't know how long I've lived in fear of this day, and now it's here. You're not making me feel any better right now, I told him.
I know that, Lieutenant, he said. I also know how hopeless our chances must seem, given what you've been told and the images you've been shown. But believe me, son, there are a lot of things about our situation and our enemy that you still don't know.
He cast a glance back over his shoulder toward a large security camera mounted above the nearest exit, sweeping its lens slowly back and forth. Then he turned back to me. And I think that was when I caught my first glimpse of something truly unsettling in my father's eyes, a hint of the very madness that I'd always feared I might have inherited from him. We can't talk now or here, he said, lowering his voice to a whisper. But things aren't nearly as hopeless as they seem, Zach. I promise you. He gave me a hopeful smile. That's why I'm so thankful you're here now. I'm going to need your help. Despite my better judgment, I went ahead and asked, with what?
With saving the world, son, my father said. You think you're up for that?
I straightened my posture, and for the first time I noticed we were now the same height.
Yes, sir, General, sir, I replied. Most definitely.
There was no mistaking the look of pride on my father's face. It was intoxicating.
I was hoping you'd say that, he said, patting me on the back. Follow me.
He turned and began to jog back out through the hangar's exit. I cast another furtive glance back over my shoulder at the gleaming fighter ships stockpiled around me. Then I turned and ran after my father, even though I still wasn't quite sure exactly where he was leading me. As General Lightman led me through the dimly lit carpeted corridors of Moonbase Alpha, I kept biting the inner wall of my cheek every few minutes, because each subsequent flash of pain was proof that I was wide awake and that this was all really happening. As we took a circuitous route down to the operations level, I marveled at how strangely familiar my new surroundings were and at how perfectly Armada's simulated version of the moon base matched the real thing. When I mentioned to my father that it looked like certain elements of the base's exterior design had been borrowed from the fictional Clavius base seen in the film 2001 A Space Odyssey, he was delighted to confirm that they had. The team of engineers who designed and built this place were in a huge hurry, so they borrowed from a lot of existing designs, he explained, motioning to the carpeted corridors around us. They stole a lot of ideas from Sid Mead and Ralph McQuarrie, like everyone else. Other people, too. He grinned. The access corridors down to the maintenance level look like they were stolen right off the set of Aliens, I swear. Wait until you see them. Once he told me all of that, I suddenly began to see evidence of sci-fi design theft everywhere I looked inside the base. Everything was sleek, ergonomic, and vaguely retro-futuristic in its design, which often appeared to favor form over function. There were also a lot of vintage Rock Band and movie posters taped up everywhere, but I was pretty sure those had been added by the base's current residents, as had the graffiti spray-painted in red on one of the corridor walls. The cake is a lie.
We also passed one corridor lined with dozens of framed photos of men and women in EDA flight officer uniforms, wearing hairstyles from at least four different decades. Each photo was accompanied by a small plaque with the officer's name and two